touchdown machine for the Houston Cougars.
Sasser again, just kind of taking over right now.
That's NBA stuff right there. He is a baller.
Stick it in your pipe and smoke it, baby.
Yes! Welcome to the Scott Holden Podcast. We are back here early Thanksgiving week, I think. Without doing the cheesy segue to the upcoming holiday, I think we're actually both back here tonight very thankful about the Houston Cougar Athletics week that was. A lot of stuff to talk about tonight from a lot of different sports, and you'll notice, I think, as you listen to this, and certainly you'll notice as a Cougar fan following the action of the programs in season right now, that it's been a lot of very good news. It's been a lot of fun stuff to watch, a lot of fun stuff to follow, and certainly some big stuff coming up here in the immediate aftermath of Turkey Day. Dustin, I am Sam. I am the co-host of this show with my good friend Dustin. I introduce myself in approximately 1% of these introductions. I am currently running on about an hour and a half sleep thanks to my red eye back from Oregon, but it was a trip to Oregon where all of us, whether in person or on TV, got to watch a Cougar men's basketball team pass its first series test of the year. One of many, I think, topics we're interested to talk about tonight. Dustin, how are you feeling off of a pretty positive week? I think we were more positive than negative last episode, but I think there was a lot more negative than there's going to be tonight. I felt really strong positive vibes as I kind of organized my thoughts from the past 6 or 7 days of athletics and looking ahead to the next 6 or 7 days.
Yeah, no, I have to say I'm pretty excited about Cougar Athletics at the moment. Good time to be podcasting. Not only men's basketball getting that passing that big test, like you mentioned, Cougar volleyball having a huge week upcoming, and you know, Cougar football just demolishing an opponent in a way that I don't think any of us expected. So it's pretty much. I guess there is the one other sport in season we'll get to that has had a less fun week, but for the most part, looking across the board, it's been a pretty good week, and like I said, lots of stuff to look forward to as well.
It's, of course, always our pleasure to announce here at the top we are proud members of the 1012 Network, talking all things Big 12 over there. The 1012 Pod, school-specific podcast, the conference that is about to be for those of us in Houston Cougar Nation. Give them a follow on Twitter, at TEN12Network. Please subscribe to the 1012 Podcast, all the great school-specific pods wherever you put podcasts in your ears. And, of course, you'll know I'm going to talk right now about Home Field Apparel, the good folks, the good brand, homefieldapparel.com. You might have heard me scream and repeat myself over and over again last week about Home Field's incredible 20% off their biggest sale of the year, Black Friday, for those of you who are new customers, those of you who are in the upper echelon of Home Field purchasers, like the two of us here at the show. It's good until this coming Sunday, the 27th. Use that promo code, check out Black Friday, all one word. Get 20% off anything there, Houston Cougars, or if you have a loved one, friend, family member who wasn't a winner of life's lottery and is not a Houston Cougar fan, the good folks at Home Field Apparel have an incredible selection of hundreds of schools, the most comfortable, the coolest logos. You're getting it all there. Homefieldapparel.com. Our good friends, they use that Black Friday promo code because it doesn't get a whole lot better than that, ladies and gentlemen. And you know what team it doesn't get a whole lot better than, Dustin? Quite literally, as they bumped up to number 2 in the AP and coaches poll, Houston Cougar men's basketball. I think we got to lead off talking about a team that I mentioned at the very top, just passed, I would say, certainly not its last test, but I would say its first serious test of the season. It wasn't always easy. It wasn't always pretty. It was never always going to be easy or pretty, but we're coming out on the other end talking about a Houston Cougar men's basketball team that won the TSU game very undramatically as expected and then went into Oregon's arena and came out winners on Sunday night in a nationally televised game that certainly tested them in a way that no one had in the current season prior.
Yeah, it was good to get the win, double-digit win on the road against a solid team like Oregon, and I thought it very much looked like Houston's first true road test of the season, and that things just didn't always run as smoothly as they had in the first four games of the season. Marcus Sasser and Jairus Walker got in early foul trouble. They got Houston got surprisingly pushed around on the boards at times. I think Infali Dante of Oregon was maybe the best player on the court on Sunday. The whistles certainly didn't go Houston's way, especially in the second half. But, you know, the Cougars kept relentlessly turning the Ducks over. They forced 16 Oregon turnovers, 13 of which came on live ball steals, turned that into 30 points. Nearly half of their game output came on points off of turnovers. And, you know, it was a game with a lot of strong performances of note, but, man, I think you have to start with Terrence Arsenal when you talk about that game, Sam. 19 minutes off the bench, 15 points to go with 3 steals and 5 boards. And when you saw Marcus Sasser go out with that foul trouble in the first half, Arsenal was huge in stepping up and providing that that instant offensive scoring boost off the bench while also positively contributing in terms of getting hands on balls, getting in the passing lanes defensively. At this point, only JVA Francis has a higher offensive rebounding rate on Houston's team than does Terrence Arsenault at this point, according to KenPom. So, you talk about the two big freshmen who came in this year for Houston. Walker has been as advertised thus far, and Arsenault sure has been as well. And, I tweeted after the game, but I think if Terrence Arsenault doesn't bring his A game, I'm not sure Houston gets the victory here.
You know, I think it's against some of those inferior opponents that we saw in the first four games before this one. Yeah, I think we saw glimpses that this could be Kelvin Sampson's deepest team. And, one guy maybe struggle with his shot, get into foul trouble, and you'd see two or three other ones step up in their place. Simply, I would say, a volume of potential go-to guys in the guard and forward groups that we haven't seen prior. And you saw in the first half when Marcus Sasser got into early foul trouble. Jairus Walker, to a slightly less extent, also picked up foul trouble, couldn't be on the court the entire time in the first half, and you saw Terrence Arsenault come out there insanely clutch, without a doubt, your Cougar MVP. I also thought Jamal Shedd in that first half, when Marcus Sasser wasn't on the court as much as you'd probably expect him to be, stepped up and had his best offensive game of the season as well. Certainly, by far, your best team three-point shooting performance, and just something you'd seen the Cougars maybe struggle with, and it didn't really matter against some of those previous opponents, and you weren't really seeing the Cougars really win those early games by shooting the lights out from deep, but with rebounding and the ability to create offense in the low post being drastically more challenging against Oregon than any of your prior opponents, you saw the Cougars really step up and rain down the threes. I mean, if you want to look at one specific thing, Dustin, the Cougars were plus 24 over the Ducks from three-point range. And as much as I'm loath to boil any sporting contest down to one single guy or one single factor like three-point shooting or rebounding or anything like that, it's almost always a number of different combination of things that go into it. I mean, I think if this team shot, at Matthew Knight Arena like they did in the first four games of the season, I have no doubt that we'd be back here talking about a Cougar loss. I have no doubt that this would not have been nearly as nearly as positive a vibe around the team as we are right now. I think. And to Terrence Arsenault, just so good. Impacted the game as much as you could possibly impact it in the 19 minutes he was in the court. Not just the offensive output, but three steals. I think he was just Mr. Right Place and Right Time. And that's kind of been what you've seen so far from him. Maybe in a bit more limited role than what you saw on Sunday night when, quite frankly, you didn't have Marcus Sasser out there. You didn't have Jairus Walker out there for points to you. You needed someone to step into that void. And Terrence Arsenault, despite only playing his fifth college game, despite playing his very first true road situation on Sunday night, did not look overawed by the moment one bit. You heard it in the preseason camp. You heard it about people who saw Arsenault play at Beaumont United. He's just different, man. He's a different cat. I know that's kind of a, it's not a very descriptive way to say it, but he just has an aura about him, and he really took over this game at times, which I don't think you necessarily expect from a freshman playing his fifth game, even one with a good recruiting pedigree and a great list of accomplishments coming into college like Arsenault had.
Yeah, I think as much as we were all excited for very good reason about seeing Jairus Walker, we did our best, and I don't know if we did enough really coming into this year to be like, yeah, but man, you know, even if Jairus Walker wasn't coming in, like, how freaking excited would we be about Terrence Arsenault coming into the season? And Arsenault has not been, you know, outshone by Walker at all. And that's not to say that Walker hasn't been great, but Arsenault has been very much the budding star in his own right. Very excited to see it. But yeah, you know, that really interesting matchup, and I think it kind of went fairly similar to what we talked about in the preview. We talked about Oregon having a lot of post size, and that they provided a very good test for the Cougs, as expected. You know, I mentioned Dante, who seemed to be everywhere at times, and you certainly don't love his four offensive rebounds or Oregon's 15 team offensive rebounds. You know, the one area where I thought Houston, you know, played kind of surprisingly not up to par was keeping the Ducks off of the offensive glass in this one. But even that, you know, with a young front court going against a more experienced Oregon, you know, bigger Oregon front court on the road in your first big road game, you know, you look up and at the end of the game, Houston was actually plus two in second chance points in this one for all those Oregon offensive rebounds. And Dante, for as much as it felt like he was having a hard time being stopped offensively at times, you look up and, you know, only attempted 8 field goals in 35 minutes to finish with a strong but not overwhelming 16 points, a point total that Marcus Sasser matched pretty quietly on the other end. And then we talked about it in the preview also. This is an Oregon team with a guard group that is, frankly, not an even match for Houston and the Cougar guards. And, you know, the Cougs played like the superior unit. They forced 7 turnovers from veteran Will Richardson. You know, Bartholomew was shooting poorly before getting injured. Soares shot poorly off the bench. Those two combined to shoot 3 of 14 from the floor. Meanwhile, you know, you mentioned it, Jamal Shedd having his best shooting game, 13 points to go with 4 assists and no turnovers. Sasser had the quiet 16. Arsenault allowed 15 off the bench. And Tremont Mark, you know, pretty quiet most of this one, but made some big plays down the stretch to help seal the deal, setting up that Sasser 3 that pushed the lead to 9 late, and then had the end one to really ice it. So expected this to be a good test for the Houston front court. It was. You know, I think they reasonably held their own in a pretty tough, hostile environment against a really, really big Oregon front court. And we expected this Houston guard group to outplay their counterparts, and they did just that. And I think it's, you know, it was, like I said, this Houston team is talented enough up and down the lineup that they're not going to have to win in the exact same way every single time. And I think the way that they needed to do it was to, you know, have the, like I said, have Jairus Walker and Juwan Robertson, those guys, and Reggie Chaney just go blow to blow with all those big Oregon 7-footers and allow this this, you know, one of the best guard groups in the country to win the game. And with largely with the 3-point shooting, like you mentioned, they were able to do just that.
You really got this team's trademark smothering defense on Sunday night. Quincy Guerrier having 12 points, but largely getting that from the free throw line, was 2 of 11 from the field and had 4 turnovers. It just, the most hilarious, him getting that flop technical and the crowd just being indignant about it, and me just like calmly clapping while everyone was just like, what? How could it be? It was absolutely fantastic. Nobody on the Ducks besides Mfali Dante and Will Richardson making more than 2 shots. And it just, no matter how much a guy like Dante is going off, and he was, I would agree with what you said earlier that if you just looked at pure individual performance, I would say he was the best on either team Sunday night. Thankfully for our Cougars, it's a team game. And we said it in the preview, though. It was hard to see where the shots, where the makes would come from those Duck guards. And I think that bore itself out. Certainly bore itself out in Will Richardson's eye-popping 7 turnovers as well, even if he shot it a little better than maybe I expected to. But I think we knew Oregon's specific size was going to be a problem. You definitely saw it at times. This is the second tallest team in Division I on average, and the only reason they're number 2 is that Western Kentucky has a 7'5 big man who regularly plays. Just the number of teams out there that compose the specific kind of size and rebounding matchup problems that this Oregon team posed on Sunday night is really, really small, maybe small enough to count on one hand. And I'm not saying that this Cougar team can't get better at rebounding the basketball, because I think Samson would freely admit that this isn't all the way there when it comes to what he wants to see his team do in terms of crashing the glass, but I also don't think Oregon being plus 9 on total rebounds and plus 9 on offensive boards is worthy of any long-term concerns, at least at this moment. And even in a game where, on the whole, the Cougars got out-rebounded pretty badly, you still saw the Cougars grab boards at critical junctures. And I think, importantly, you didn't see the Ducks really use that rebounding edge, like you said, to get over the hump, to retake the lead. They didn't have an advantage in second chance points. So, yes, they had that rebounding advantage. Yes, it gave them some more chances, but quite often they were chances they were missing. And you gotta tip your cap to Dante, though. He was a totally different dude than the one I saw almost a year ago at the Maui Invitational. And it just, it's no longer that he has the raw size. He now has the strength. He now has the post moves. And I know it's a small sample size, but in this current season, he's averaging 4 offensive rebounds per game. I don't know if that's sustainable over a full year. I have little doubt still he'll be one of the country's better offensive rebounders when it's all said and done. I mean, I think I wouldn't read too much into the lack of Jawan Roberts and really most of the Cougar big men in this offense. I think you got to know what's feasible game to game sometimes, and trying to run alive your offense through the post when your opponent has a 6'11 senior like Dante, who's clearly feeling himself on both ends of the floor, a couple other 7-footers, and you don't have any rotation guys over 6'8. It's just not really an area you could probably take advantage of. And on a broader level, I think you also saw this Cougar team's resolve get tested. There was that 10-point lead in the first half. Oregon didn't allow you to extend it. Ended up becoming a 1-score lead for a good early part of the second half. And even, I think most importantly, you got out to that 58-42 lead in the second half. Really looked like at that point you were going to do what you had done to several teams prior and kind of just run them out of their own gym. And Oregon looked pretty dead in the water. And that was cut to 6 with Oregon, I think, having more than enough time. I think it was 6 points at about the 2.5-minute mark. 2.5 minutes is plenty of time to cut a 6-point deficit, though I think with the Cougars defending like they were, I think maybe not as feasible as I'm saying, but the point being, Oregon didn't let you run them out of their gym, and maybe it's unrealistic to expect this opponent to roll over, I guess, in their own building. And I think seeing that specific kind of adversity, the act of having to hold off an opponent who's cut your big lead to only a few points, is just itching to get that lead. You just, being in the building there, Dustin, at that point where the Cougars had 2 and 3-point leads, you could just feel it. If they got a 3-pointer, that place was going to explode. The student section was going to go nuts, and you were going to start to see how hard it is to win a road game. And the Cougars never let that basket happen. It got very close, it got very tight, but the Cougs never let their opponent truly, I think, smell blood in the water. And this isn't going to be the last time this year that U of H will go into an opponent's gym and be a marquee name on the schedule, get the accompanying big game home crowd. And also, I got to mention, I just, you could imagine every minute that went by that Oregon didn't get called for a foul, I just was muttering to myself, yeah, sure, we played 16 minutes of basketball and Oregon has committed 0 fouls. It got to almost 19 minutes of basketball before Oregon, quote unquote, committed a foul. I know that Oregon was doing more of the things that will generally get foul calls, putting the ball in the low post, you know, going to the basket, whereas the Cougars, I think, got a lot more of their points in the perimeter. So I understand why there would be a foul disparity. I just refuse to understand or accept that Oregon committed zero instances of a play worthy of a foul call. Not to mention Jamal Shea getting hit in the face. Jamal Shea gets hit in the face. No foul call, but like 9 phantom foul calls on Quincy Guerrier and Folly Dante.
I was going to say, it might have been a little bit easier to accept the foul disparity or the 0 foul calls if it wasn't for, yeah, Jamal Shea just getting smacked in the face pretty early on in the half. So
he had to go out. He had to go out because he got smacked in the face.
Really no excuse for the foul total to be 0 after that. But either way, I Kelvin Sampson talked after the game about, you know, this is not, Houston is not playing its best basketball this season right now. It's November. Obviously, you hope your team's going to get better over the course of the season, and that's something that we've seen very consistently under Kelvin Sampson, is that his teams have gotten better over the course of the season. So as much as there were some things in this game that were some imperfections, certainly in how Houston played, this is not the final version of your Houston Cougars. And I agree with you that I don't think that even having the rare poor, you know, rebounding game is anything to be too stressed out about. And, you know, I think there's things that you learn from yourself about playing a team like this that you don't necessarily learn from playing in those first 4 games. But there's also, you know, some ways in which the Oregon game is not going to tell you a whole lot of the rest of your season, because you're not going to play too many teams that have an Enfali Dante or just the, like, you know, 3 or 4, 6'11", 7-foot guys that Oregon had. Like you said, one of the tallest teams in the country. So, you know, you're not really going to face it. I don't think Western Kentucky's in the schedule, so you're not going to really face a team with that kind of monstrous size again. But you do learn some things about yourself from going up against a team like that. You know, it's when you are facing a team with a significant amount of size, how do you deal with that? And Houston got a first good test of how they dealt with that. you get your freshmen their first test of what it's like playing college basketball, on the road in a hostile environment that was ready to explode at any second. Those tests are valuable, win or lose. Even if you lose a game like this, it is valuable to learn those things about yourself playing there. There's a reason that a team like Gonzaga, as good as they are, and there's a reason they're going out and playing just an insane murderer's row in non-conference, and it's because even if they lose a few of those, that you don't want to go through your whole season not having had some tests like that. So playing a team like Oregon on the road, it's a good test. And Houston, not only did they get to learn some things about themselves, but they got to learn some things about themselves. And for the experience, they had the benefit of a road win that's probably not going to look terrible on their resume at the end of the season. So, like I said, definitely some things you could pick some nits and say that there are some things. And certainly Kelvin Sampson's not going to leave this game with nothing to go talk to his team about ways that they could improve for the rest of the season. But you have to be happy with the overall effort and certainly the final result.
I think even in those imperfections in the performance, I still think we saw a team capable of greatness. And I think still in the earliest stages of figuring some stuff out, of learning how to play together. For a lot of guys, this is only their fifth game playing together. And their fifth game playing together and still playing like one of the two or three best teams in the sport. I think that's why I find so enjoyable generally about college basketball. You alluded to Gonzaga, and Gonzaga took a pretty decisive loss on the road in Austin to a certain burnt orange school. And I saw some people pointing out that the defending national champion, the Kansas Jayhawks, got absolutely run out of the gym, I want to say, by Kentucky at the start of last season. That'll happen. You learn more about yourself in November, December, January. Inevitably, you'll see a team like Kansas, like Gonzaga, that will get run out of the building in an early, November, December, January game, and we'll find that other gear in March and will be better for the experience. If you're extremely good, you'll find the other gear going into the early part of April. I think Kelvin Sampson said it best after the game. He said, "We didn't play great, but it's not time to play great. It's November. November is about winning and learning, and that's what we did today." And I think that sums it up pretty well. I think this team will need to be better to beat Virginia in Charlottesville in about a month, and certainly against Bama and St. Mary's, who both look like varying degrees of very good basketball teams. But there's nothing saying that this Cougar team can't be better by those points as well. Again, only the fifth real game this group of guys have largely played together. And we know a Kelvin Sampson coach team is going to improve as the season progresses and they get more reps together. I think it's pretty exciting that we're at this point five games in already and still have the ability to beat a good team on their court. Your first time for a lot of guys experiencing that situation, still coming out a double-digit winner where you led about 75% of the game.
So strong game five for Houston. Game six will be on Saturday when they will host the Golden Flashes of Kent State. Kent State, kind of a surprisingly interesting team to preview, more so than would have expected coming into the year. They're in year 12 under head coach Rob Senderoff. They've never been a top 100 KenPom team under Senderoff. They've only been to one NCAA tournament, losing in the first round. But you look up and all of a sudden they're 4-0 against D1 competition, including a pair of, I would say, surprisingly comprehensive wins over some decent Northern Kentucky and Portland teams. They're 87 in KenPom at the moment, and they actually have a road game against Charleston on Wednesday. Those other Cougars have looked pretty solid themselves this year. If Kent State can win that one too, they might actually end up being a decent little strength of schedule boost, more so than one might have guessed before the year. And one of the interesting things about them this year, especially as it pertains to their 12th year head coach, is that they're currently playing at a much faster pace than they have at any time during Senderoff's tenure. They're averaging almost 73.5 possessions per game, about 9 more per game than the Cougs. So pretty interesting clash of styles here in terms of the speed of the game. Not that Houston isn't perfectly happy to get out in transition when appropriate, but against a team that has been kind of against their coaches, overall tendency, been running it pretty quickly this year, makes for a game that I'm more intrigued by than I thought it was going to be before the season started.
Definitely a team that's a cut below the quartet of teams that we kind of expect in the preseason to be the strongest in the non-conference slate: Oregon, Bama, Virginia, and St. Mary's. But I would say they're also a decent cut above the four teams we saw UH open the season with before that roadie to Oregon. They're 5-0 to date, I think, like you said. I think with the context that one of those five wins didn't even come against a D1 opponent, and the most recent of the 2-5 were against two of the lowest rated 10 teams or so in Division One, Arkansas Pine Bluff and Chicago State. So hard to glean too much from any of that, but I think that game on Wednesday against the College of Charleston will be, I think, pretty telling. I think certainly got to give them a second look if they're able to beat a good Charleston team in this week, and that they've played extremely up-tempo, like you said. Again, wonder how much of that is them experimenting with this against some inferior opponents, and an interesting contrast to a Cougar team that has been extremely deliberate to this point. I think what I really noticed was they've been good early on at getting to the free throw line. The Cougs are always going to be a team that's a bit more foul happy, always going to be on the lower end in terms of allowing opponents to get to the charity stripe, just because the physical brand defense that a Kelvin Sampson team is always going to play. But I think another thing that maybe favors the Cougars is the Golden Flash have really struggled so far, even against some not great opponents, from keeping said opponents from grabbing offensive rebounds. That's always going to be something that's a year in, year out strength of the Cougars, and maybe something to look at, that the Golden Flash have struggled at something U of H is so consistently good at. I thought this was interesting, Dustin. We talked a whole lot about Oregon's size and the specific size challenges of facing that Ducks team, and they're the second tallest team in the country. Kent State, bit of a different look as the 348th tallest team in the country. I would still say, regardless of how they do against the College of Charleston, this is a team the Cougars should beat, but I would certainly expect more of a challenge from this group than maybe the Northern Colorados or TSUs on your schedule.
Yeah, I think the thing is that scary, you kind of, like you mentioned, the number one, it's the getting to the free throw line a lot. You pair veteran guards and Malik Jacobs and Sincere Carey, who can score at all three levels. They get to the line, they make free throws once they get there. And also that they force, they've been forcing a ton of turnovers. And that's somewhere that, an area that obviously U of H has excelled, like we talked about, especially in the Oregon game. But this is a team, you know, Kent State on their night can kind of neutralize that Houston advantage by also forcing turnovers of their own at the other end. So that's something that Houston has to watch out for. But yeah, you mentioned it. I mean, going from rebounding and going up against a team with Oregon size, and then getting pushed around on the boards and knowing that Kelvin Sampson was going to have some things to talk to his guys about in practice, and then getting almost a full week of being reminded how Oregon pushed you around on the boards at times before you go up against a Kent State team that doesn't have very much size and hasn't been rebounding real well. Yeah, that feels like this one might get a little bit ugly in terms of Houston asserting themselves on the glass. The Cougs will then be hosting Norfolk State next Tuesday. I guess we'll talk about that one, since that'll probably be before our next episode, I would guess. Less of an interesting team to preview. The Spartans' season has been a one of pairs thus far. They opened the season with a pair of non-D1 opponents, winning both of those comfortably. They then played two really, really good teams back-to-back in Baylor and UCLA, losing by 17 and 30 respectively, and then bounced back with a pair of games against really bad teams, but D1 teams at least this time, in Monmouth and Alabama A&M, winning those games pretty narrowly by 5 and 6 points respectively. And you know, even more so than Kent State, you know, very little size, very bad rebounding team. When they've played tops teams, they've gotten crushed on the glass and in turnovers. And without, I think, going any further into this preview than is really necessary, just gonna say I expect the Cougs to continue those trends.
Agreed. I think this one shouldn't be terribly close. We'll point out Norfolk State is the MEAC's top KenPom team by a pretty wide margin, and a team that's coming off two straight years of getting the MEAC auto bid and going to the NCAA tournament. So not a slouch in that regard, but still a team the Cougars should expect to beat and beat comfortably, even if they're one of the better HBCU programs out there.
And then while we are talking Houston Cougar men's basketball, before we changed gears entirely, did want to mention the verbal commitment that came in the past week for the Cougar men's basketball team in the class of 2023 from one Cedric Lott, 6'9 center out from, I believe, what, your neck of the woods in Nevada there now, Sam. I believe hometown of San Diego, but now playing out near Nevada. Lott, a high three-star recruit in the 247 composite. His final three schools that he took official visits to and was down to were Houston, BYU, and UT Austin. Also had offers from TCU, UCLA, among others. Really nice get for the Cougs. You know, I was a little bit surprised to see them sign a third forward in the 2023 class, already having JoJo Tugler and Jacob McFarland signed, but someone with Lott's you know, size and ability and recruiting pedigree, certainly someone that you'd have to be intrigued by what he could bring, and excited to see this this coaching staff going out against some of the big boys in terms of their future conference mates and future probably brief conference mates, and going head to head and getting a win on the recruiting trail.
maybe not the most hyped guy. I think he was the number 154 guy in the class of 2023, according to 247 Sports, came to the United States via the Ivory Coast. So I think that he's done as much as he has in terms of his prep career, having not played the game of basketball. That was one of the first things Samson mentioned we talked about a lot after he signed his NLI, was that he really hasn't been playing organized basketball that long, and he's already done as much as he had. I think Samson really emphasized that he's a developmental guy, but that he's a developmental guy with just potentially boundless ceiling once he reached that, once he acclimates to Division I game. He, I believe I saw, will be joining the program for the spring semester, so that'll be a good chance for him to kind of get acclimated to Division I, to, I think, do what we've seen a lot of guys do, guys previously like Caleb Mills, like Emmanuel Sharp on this year's team, to kind of get their body a little closer playing college basketball. I don't know if he's somebody we should expect to see in 2023, but I would say 2024 and beyond could be a very exciting prospect. Somebody Samson clearly thinks can develop into something far higher than maybe what you would normally expect the number 154 rated guy in a class to be.
All right, and then sticking with the hoops, we'll go over to the women's team, who had a tough loss this week, losing their game from the past week at home to Florida State in overtime by a final score of 79-73. Game of runs in a big way. Houston fell behind big in the first quarter, trailed by as many as 11. They fought back, led briefly by a point in the second quarter, went into halftime tied. But in the second half, we got essentially a replay of the first half, where Florida State came out hot, went up 9. The Cougs fought back, actually took the lead, went back and forth for a little bit late in the game, or late in regulation, I should say. T.R. Young ended up getting an incredible steal with 10 seconds to go, with Houston down 2 points, turned it into a game-tying layup to send the game to overtime. But unfortunately, the whole Florida State starting out on the front foot in every other quarter thing continued into overtime, a.k.a. quarter number 5. The Seminoles opened the extra period on a 10-2 run, and that was pretty much that. Houston ends up losing by 6. And, you know, on the starting with the positives, I guess, there were certainly some things to like from the Cougs in this one. Tatiana Hill, another really strong game, shot 8 of 13 from the floor for 16 points to go with 9 boards and 6 steals for Tatiana Hill in this one. Layla Blair, 19 points, although it took her 23 shots to get there. She also added a career-high 9 rebounds. And, you know, something we wanted to see more of, Houston was able to force a ton of turnovers while doing a good job of holding onto the basketball themselves. They forced 26 Florida State turnovers on 16 steals, compared to just 11 Cougar turnovers on the other end. They won points off turnover 19-4 in this one. But you say all that, but the bugaboo for Houston continues to be putting the ball in the basket. The Cougs scored 73 points in this one, which seems like a fair offensive output, on the front, but, you know, factoring in how many turnovers they got, how many offensive rebounds they had, the game going to overtime, the game being played at a very high tempo. Houston actually attempted 93 field goal attempts in this one, and 73 points on 93 shots just isn't that great. It's what happens when you only make a third of your shots, less than a quarter of your threes, and less than half of your free throws, which is unfortunately what Houston did in this one. So, you know, devoid of context, losing in overtime to a good team like Florida State, not devastating certainly, but in the context of starting the season 1-2, Sam, feels like a big missed opportunity to grab the momentum changing win that Houston really needs right now.
It was tantalizing. That was potentially your signature win right there. And no doubt, you saw the way this team came back. No doubt that this team hasn't stopped fighting. It's been a frustrating start to the year, but there's no doubt this team is not going through the motions. This is a team that badly wants to win, but I think it's a hard hill to climb when you're still struggling to put the ball in the basket like this team is doing. And I think that Florida State team we knew coming in was a skilled group, was going to be the best offensive opponent we'd see in the young season so far. I think they lived up to advertising, and credit to the Cougars that they were able to keep it close, but just very frustrating to see that cycle, like you said, repeat, repeat, and repeat. It has been really cool, even though the team results haven't gone exactly how you'd want them to date, that Tatiana Hill, I think, has had a really strong start to the season. It's good to see her realizing some of the potential that we'd seen in flashes, but really had maybe seen put all together. And through 4 games, I think it's shown you as much as any front court player has shown under Ron Huey in a good long while. I think now it's a test of whether it's going to be a first several games of the season thing, or whether that's going to continue on into December into conference play.
And we'll get a couple more data points this week as Houston will be in St. Petersburg over this weekend to play a couple of games in a multi-team event. They'll start with Portland on Thanksgiving Day. The Pilots went 18-11 last year, finished in the top 80 of the RPI, or of the net, I should say. But it's been a bit of a struggle this year. They'll be matching Houston's 1-3 record against D1 competition when these teams face off. Opened the season with a 16-point win over Hawaii. Actually got number 2 Stanford to come to Portland to crush them on their own home court, which I don't think there's necessarily anything to speak ill of Portland for, but following that up with a road trip to San Diego and losing back-to-back games against San Diego State and UC San Diego teams that weren't very good last year is a little bit less forgivable. So, you know, I guess really not a dissimilar team from Houston thus far this year in terms of coming off a respectable season, but wanting to take the next step and instead feeling like you're kind of spinning in place or slipping backwards with a pair of road losses to some underwhelming opponents. So, you know, leading scorer is a forward, not the case with a lot of college teams, especially on the women's side, but 6'2 forward Alex Fowler scoring better than 14 points per game this far should provide a good test for Tatiana Hill and the Cougs.
Yeah, I was going to say that matchup of her versus the front court of Patterson, Tatiana Hill will certainly be an individual matchup to watch. A good win if you can get it. I agree with you. A team that profiles pretty similarly to the Cougs, at least through the young season so far.
And the Cougs staying in St. Petersburg to face the Florida Gators on Saturday. Gators, one of the last at-larges to last year's NCAA tournament. They lost in the first round as a 10 seed to UCF. They're 4-1 this year, but their four wins are to four of the biggest cupcakes available to schedule. And that one loss came by 15 points against the Florida State team that Houston just took to overtime. The Gators led in scoring by 6-foot senior guard Leilani Correa, who would actually come off the bench in all five games, but is scoring upwards of 16.5 points per game off the bench. Kind of weird. I was looking at their team, not sure what to make of this. In four of their five games this year, they have started all three of 6'6" Rashaya Kyle, 6'4" Faith Dutt, and 6'3" Jordan Merritt. But then, like, rarely played with all three of them together for the rest of the game, mostly just have running two forwards out there the rest of the way. So I'm not sure what the whole starting three forwards just to show off and maybe try to intimidate the other team is about, but they do just go back to mostly running two forwards the rest of the way. So not sure what to make of that, but, you know, just kind of based on the results this year, it feels like another game where, you know, challenging game for Houston, especially what in is essentially a, you know, maybe semi-road game with certainly being less of a trip for Florida than for Houston there, but not an unwinnable game. You know, we talked about in the season preview how Houston has a lot of those types of games on their schedule. So, you know, 1-3, but it's not where Houston wants to be, but it's a new week and they've got a couple of chances to build some positive momentum.
I was going to say, is this like the women's basketball version of when a football team has the very biggest and most intimidating player come first out of the bus? I don't know. It's very weird. It kind of feels like what Oregon does, because Oregon, on the men's side, we just got done talking about, runs out that super tall lineup, but Oregon actually tried to play basketball with them. So, yeah, very weird.
All right, so moving right along, we got some Cougar volleyball staying hot, staying undefeated in American Athletic Conference play with a sweep over Memphis, a 3-1 win over SMU. Start with that sweep over the Tigers on Friday. The Cougs established a new program record with their 18th straight win, a comfortable sweep of a Memphis team that we did not expect them to have too much trouble with. And, you know, Houston didn't have the one like super dominant set like we see they often do, where they just embarrassed some team for a set, but they were in control of all three, which is maybe better. They won 25-20, 25-18, 25-18, and just really strong defensive performance, holding Memphis to a 119 hitting percentage. Kate Georgiadis, strong as always, 23 digs in just three sets, continues to climb up the NCAA leaderboard right at 5.5 digs per set now. That's good for number 8 in the country. And, you know, I've said it before, but to reiterate, there's no one near her on the NCAA leaderboard that's doing that for a similarly top 25 caliber, even NCAA caliber type team. So another strong performance from her, and the, you know, dominant sweep of the Tigers that we pretty well expected.
And that, in terms of big picture takeaway, you alluded to it, the trend of the Cougs improving their second time against an opponent, you saw continued in this one. It's not to say the Tigers were wildly uncompetitive, but I don't think I'm being unfair to our visitors in saying that this one was a lot less competitive than that first head-to-head matchup in Memphis. If you'll recall, that first meeting was also a 3-0 Cougar sweep win, but was honestly insanely close, and Memphis had set points in two of those three sets, and the Cougs had to come back from the brink to even get that sweep, and thankfully Freya's penultimate, home regular season game was a bit less dramatic. And if you haven't seen already, I think you could certainly find it on any social media platform that Cougar Volleyball is on, but the winning point by the Cougars in the opening set is absolutely crazy. One of the longest rallies you'll ever see before the Cougars finally won that point. Well, mentioned it, K-George asked, really impressive 23 digs, but I thought it was really cool that Abby Jackson, Morgan Yanda, and Kennedy Warren also had 10 apiece. Only five service aces for either team, I think, evidence of good defensive work by both teams. The best Memphis hit in any of their three sets was 182, and that Memphis never held a lead in this one, and also had more than 5 points in any of the sets. You know, none of the sets were blowouts, I would say, but you really saw throughout this one, the Cougars take control early and often and really never left a doubt who's going to win this one.
And then the Cougars got another win on Sunday over SMU, 3-1. Can't believe they dropped a set, Sam. Unbelievable. What is this team? What
disband
is this team
the program.
To? Fire David Rare.
Terrible. Terrible.
We dropped a set to SMU. No, just kidding. But no, Houston drops a set for the first time since October 21st. Gasp.
30 calendar days.
Still comfortably beat the third place team in the conference, SMU, dominating set 125-15, taking a highly competitive set 2 before dropping a highly competitive set 3, and then holding the Ponies at arm's length for a 25-19 set 4 victory to seal it off. And I gotta start with Cortland Henderson, had one of her best games as a Coug, a team high 14 kills against two attack errors, and Houston's middle blockers were dominant. Rachel Tullis 6 blocks, Kellen Morin had 5, so you know, strong effort by the Cougs. Not going to stress about the dropping one set, obviously. You know, we knew SMU was the one team that could still trip Houston up before their season-ending showdown with UCF, and the Cougs passed the test to get to 18-0 in conference play, Sam.
Yeah, and the Cougs, before that final drop set, had won 28 straight sets within that program record setting and still active winning streak. And even in the set that SMU won, the Mustangs needed to go past the usual 25-point threshold to even win the set. You know, I think, not surprisingly, after that set loss, Cougs didn't look rattled, didn't look thrown off in any way by this happening. SMU didn't go quietly into the night, but after the fourth set was tied by 15, the Cougs went on a 5-0 run, took the game by the scruff of the neck, and SMU really wasn't ever able to get close again to get to that 3-1 win. Closed the season with a perfect 14-0 slate at home. I think that's really cool. And I think really awesome that the four players you honored for Senior Day all had really impactful performances. Cortland Henderson had a team-high 14 kills, hit a fantastic 500 for the match, also had 3 total blocks. Kennedy Warren was just a hair behind K-George Yass and Abby Jackson with 16 digs, had 7 kills of her own, Isabel Toyd had 12 kills and 2 blocks. And I thought this was really cool. Your one backup senior, Jillian Thompson, came out there and had a block and a kill in her final Cougar home game. As well, of course, you got a double-double from Abby Jackson. A demonstration, I thought it was really cool, the 11 kills and 18 digs, that Abby Jackson is no longer, I mean, she's always been a good offensive weapon for your team. We've known it basically since she stepped on a Division I court, but I think this game is as good of a demonstration as any that she's really evolved from being a great offensive threat to being a great, great, great all-around player. Morgan Yanda and Annie Cook combined for 39 assists in the 4 sets. As well, just a great team win against a good opponent. I think the closest thing to a good RPI win that you're going to get from the conference schedule outside of UCF. And I thought the Cougars, even with the loss set there, did a really good job taking care of business on Senior Day.
And very notably, Senior Day did not include any of the Cougar seniors who have that extra COVID year that they can still use next year, including one Abby Jackson. So very, very interesting potential development for 2023 Houston Cougar volleyball as they head into the Big 12. But can't worry about that yet. Still a lot to worry about in the more immediate future, which includes Houston's final week of the regular season, which is this coming week, as they will play their final two matches on the road, starting with a contest at South Florida on Wednesday. The Bulls are not good. They're 4-14 in American Athletic Conference play. You may remember when these teams faced off at the Fertitta Center that UCF or USF. Hopefully that was the last time.
They don't like it when you confuse them, Dustin.
I hope they're not listening to this podcast. I'm glad we're not playing them in football this week. So there's no. I don't think any of them are listening. USF poured absolutely everything they had into the third set, miraculously winning it 25-23. The Cougars just dominated the other three sets by like ludicrous is 12, 12, and 13-point margins. So this is a match that Houston should control easily. And Sam, I don't think I'm jinxing it. I'll knock on wood as I say this, I guess, just to be on the safe side. But when Houston does that, when they dispatch with USF on Wednesday, they will clinch a share of their first ever American Athletic Conference championship. And that is very cool. And as much as we're excited about next year in the Big 12, as much as we're excited about a couple weeks from now in the NCAA tournament, you know, and doing that for the first time in a couple of decades, it's also very, very cool that this team has, you know, absolutely in their grasp to go ahead and win the American, at the very least a share of it, something that barely seemed like a conceivable goal when David Rare took over this program.
Yeah, and for all the excitement of going to the Big 12, and that's righteous excitement because that's going to be a very good volleyball league. It's going to be a very good league for Cougar athletics generally. In almost a decade in the American, it's not like we were dominating American volleyball out of the gate. We were usually, until David Rare got here, a bottom half of the league team. We were a team a lot more similar to South Florida than UCF, and it's been really cool since 2019 to see the transformation of this program under David Rare. And with respect to South Florida's roster, I'm sure full of Division I volleyball players. I'm not on the volleyball team, so I can overlook them. I have carte blanche to do that. I don't think that's going to be too much of a problem for the Cougs on Wednesday afternoon.
And part of the reason it's so tempting to overlook USF is because on Friday they'll be in Orlando taking on UCF. And, you know, hey, even with a share of the conference title presumably wrapped up at this point, which, you know, here I'm also assuming that not only that Houston will handle the Bulls, but also that UCF will handle Tulane on Wednesday, which seems likely given that both Houston and the Knights have pretty comfortably dispatched every conference foe up until this point. But if it does, both of those teams take care of business, then it'll all be 19-0 Houston versus 18-1 UCF. Coming to, you know, can Houston get greedy? Can they beat the Knights again? Can they claim sole possession of that conference title for their very own? The Cougs, of course, remain the only loss on the schedule all year for the Knights, who are 25-1 overall. Obviously, that makes them undefeated at home this year. And we've talked about how Houston has, you know, especially the second time through conference play, not just beaten teams, but, you know, swept them, thrashed them. And that's been UCF for most of the year, too. They're on a run of five straight sweeps right now. Other than when Houston beat them, nobody else has taken them to five sets at any point in conference play. Number two in the country in hitting percentage, and they're going to want very badly to prove that that dominant defensive performance that Houston had against them at the Fertitta Center can't be replicated in Orlando. Sam, I know that you, just like me, can hardly wait for this one on Friday.
Yeah, Knights are really freaking good. Like you said, haven't lost a game since that loss to U of H at Houston. Only blemish on their current season. They've swept five straight matches coming into this week, and no opponent in conference play besides Houston has won more than a single set against the Knights in American Athletic Conference play. Like I said, really freaking good team. McKenna Melville, their star player, with over double the kills, is the next highest UCF player, represents over a third of the team's total number of kills, along with being one of the best, I would say, actually active offensive players currently in Division One. To hit 327 like she's done and be as much of a high usage outside hitter as she is, it's absurd. I think if you're newer to volleyball and need some kind of comparison, to me, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Dustin, it's like a basketball player who volume shoots on three-pointers and still makes over 40% of them. She's such a feature of what the Knights do offensively, and yet still is quite efficient as well. Another fifth-year player, Amber Olsa, is their primary setter. A really veteran team, a really good volleyball team. I think just an endorsement of the Cougars that they're able to take them down in four sets in Houston, because it's a very, very strong opponent. Really, any statistical category you look at, offense, defense, the Knights are a really strong team, not a team with any obvious weaknesses. And I guess you don't get to where the Cougs or UCF are without being very complete and very hard to beat. Worth noting, last year, the Cougars actually split the season series by winning the game in Orlando. So, not saying that's going to make them any more or less likely to win, but certainly not a mental block against winning on this court, something that a number of the players on this team have done prior. This was a team, actually, like last year, the Cougars were one set away from sweeping UCF, but obviously, very good team. The Cougars weren't nearly as good as they are this year. The Knights took the last three sets at the Fertitta Center to end last season. It's not going to be easy. It would be a perfect way to end such a remarkable regular season to get that 20th win against this really good opponent. But I would also caution against being too disappointed, because win or lose, whether you're 20-0 or 19-1, next time we come here and record, this has been a really freaking good season, and a season that is not going to end after that win or loss to UCF, Dustin. Isn't that right? Apparently, teams play for a apparently volleyball teams play after late November for a postseason championship.
Sure. No, I want to get to that. Just a couple last thoughts of the game. I am really intrigued to see how Houston does against Melville. You mentioned how prolific she's been. The Cougs did a remarkable job of shutting her down when these teams faced off, and really just did a remarkable job of holding that UCF offense to its, you know, worst match of the year by far. But on the same token, on the other end, UCF is one of the few teams that held Houston to a sub 200 hitting percentage this year as well. So it would be damn near impossible for Houston to play better defensively than they did the first time they played UCF. But I think they can get a little bit better offensively. So I'm real intrigued to see how both of those sides of the match go. But you know, huge match, should be tons of fun. And like I said, no conference tournament. So this is it before we get to find out Houston's NCAA tournament fate, which we will on this coming Sunday, November the 27th at 6:30 p.m. Central, which is when the women's volleyball NCAA tournament selection show is. It'll be broadcast on ESPNU if you want to catch that. And as we've said, we can say with certainty Houston will be in the field of 64 for the first time since the year 2000. And since the NCAA volleyball postseason is a very new thing to Houston as of this podcast's existence, and since the whole tournament and seeding process is actually getting an overhaul this year anyway, here is a quick rundown on what to expect for that. The tournament is broken down into 16 regionals, much like baseball, with the top 16 teams in the country as selected by the selection committee, hosting pods of four teams. Houston is currently number 17 in the RPI as of this evening. UCF is number 18, so if Houston were to get a road win to finish out the regular season, I think it's possible that they could play themselves into hosting contention there. But even if Houston does not get to host, there's still some important seeding considerations. The new seeding strategy this year is that the top 32 teams will get seeded, with four teams each seeded 1 through 8. So the top four teams are all number one seeds. The next four teams are all number two seeds, etc., down to number 8, and then just no one gets ranked below number 8. So it's kind of like the basketball tournament in that sense of, you know, having this bracket with 1 through 8 and everything, but with just no one lower than 8 ranked, and, you know, geography and travel costs playing more of a consideration where it goes at that point. So, you know, if Houston doesn't host and if they are able to win their first round match, then they would likely have to face the regional host in the second round. So at that point, it very much matters what seed you get from the committee, because, you know, one seeds are hosting regionals, so are two seeds, so are three seeds, so are four seeds. So if Houston, let's say, you know, loses to UCF, and you kind of know you're probably not in hosting consideration at that point, well, are you a five seed where you face one of the weaker regional hosts in the second round, or, you know, a six? Or, you know, I certainly wouldn't think Houston would be a 7 or an 8, but the point is, seeding matters. And then my last thought here, Sam, before I throw it over to you here, is very interestingly, Rice is currently number 14 in the RPI, so it seems like a very conceivable scenario would be Rice hosting as a four seed, Houston being one of the top non-host teams and getting a five seed, and then being set up for a rematch with the Owls in the second round of the NCAA tournament right here in the city of Houston, if both teams can take care of business in the first round. So obviously would love to see Houston close out the season undefeated in conference play and make the committee really think about giving them a host themselves. But it would be awfully intriguing to potentially have that that matchup with Rice in the second round there.
Would be some nice delayed revenge to have one of your very, very few regular season losses get a potential rematch in the postseason. That would be really cool. And it being kind of a traditional rival in the Rice Owls, that would be pretty awesome. Not that it wouldn't be awesome to host as well. And I think it certainly probably doesn't hurt that, although I wonder if I don't know. I wonder if there's a scheduling conflicts or anything like that, or if that's consideration. Although I'm sure in terms of the facility's niceness, I don't think Vertita Center is too shabby for postseason volleyball.
No, certainly you're not. You're going to get turned down for hosting if you're putting the Fertitta Center out there. But yeah, would be really interested to know the last time Houston has faced Rice in the NCAA tournament in any sport, because I can't imagine when the last time
that baseball. Would be.
You're right.
I want to say the 2000. Yeah, the 2003 season where Rice won it all. I believe
they beat us in the Supers,
at the Supers.
Yeah. Oh, no, and we hosted them. We hosted them in a regional more. When we hosted the regional, they were here, right?
2017. Since this podcast has existed, yeah.
There you go. A whopping I can't imagine what that possibly is 5 years ago. It would be really cool, if it's not as historical as I thought it was. I'm a little bit disappointed now, but it would still be awfully cool if that's what it played out. But obviously, even cooler if we host. But either way, excited to see what happens with the Cougs and where they get to go. We'll learn that, like I said, on Sunday evening. And then, obviously, did want to mention Cougar football, as we are now well into this podcast here. I guess we can talk about the football team as well, which we alluded to up top. Absolutely crushed the East Carolina Pirates 42-3 this past Saturday. And if you listen to Sam and myself previewing this game last week, you know that we were not especially optimistic that Houston was going to win this one. And, you know, I certainly believe that Houston winning this one was within the realm of possibility, but you'd have had to try really hard to convince me before kickoff that the Cougs delivering a 42-3 spanking to the Pirates had a snowball's chance in hell of coming to fruition. And yet, Sam, that's exactly what happened. So I will not bogart at the mic here and pass it off to you to tell the good folks how this one was won.
Yeah, I think if you had told me the Cougars we're going to win this game and score 42 points, I'm like, okay, you know, the offense went off. That's not too surprising. The offense has been quite good here in the latter half of the season, but I would have figured a 42-35, 42-38 kind of game would have been on the offing, not a 39-point win on ECU senior day in front of what I would say is at worst the second best home field advantage in the American Athletic Conference, holding that opponent to not scoring a single touchdown, even in garbage time. I think quite shocking. Handed ECU the most lopsided loss since Mike Houston took over in 2019, the most lopsided loss period since the end of the 2018 season. And obviously, like you said, we should probably talk at least briefly about how the Cougars got from point A to point B and handed ECU a beatdown that was very welcome among Cougar fans, but also very surprising. I think on the most simple level, the Cougars really won this one by getting out to a hot start, which hadn't always been this team's strong suit in the current season, and they never really let it get close or nervy, never really let the crowd at Dowdy-Ficklin Stadium get back into the game. They took a 3-touchdown lead late in the second quarter with that Brandon Campbell touchdown run where he just went untouched into the ECU end zone. Prior to that, the Cougs had opened the scoring on their first possession, had a ruthlessly efficient 7-play, 77-yard drive after ECU had an empty opening possession. Clayton Toon would double that lead in the second quarter by finding Christian Trahan in the early second quarter for a passing touchdown. And the Cougs got the ball up 21 to start the second half. And at that point, you know, you didn't want to boil any game with two quarters down to one possession. But at that point, ECU gets a stop and gets a score. It's a two-score game with almost two quarters left, which is, against this Cougar defense, a not super impossible hill to climb, but Cougs marched down the field in their first possession at over 10 yards of play, just like they did to start the first half. Got the lead out to 28-0 with an absolutely gorgeous touchdown reception from Matthew Golden, who had a career game coming off that game-winning touchdown grab the previous week against Temple. ECU did respond after the Cougars' 28-0 lead with a third-quarter drive of their own, but it really felt like the opposite of a galvanizing score, even in real time. You heard that when ECU sent out the field goal unit on fourth and goal from the 4-yard line, I think the loudest that crowd got all day was booing Mike Houston's decision to go for the field goal there. And if there were any slight remaining doubts, Clayton Toon would find Matthew Golden for another touchdown on the next drive to make it 35-3 Cougars and truly put ECU out of its misery in, I would say, as rough of a senior day as that Pirates program has ever had. Tazon Henry, who I think was an underrated positive as well in this one, tacked on a fourth quarter touchdown run to make the final score 42-3. And I thought, impressively, even in garbage time, ECU couldn't find the end zone. Cougs leave Dowdy-Ficklin with a 39-point win. Dustin, there are a lot of places we could start in this one, and I would say all those places are very positive. So where would you like to start us off on this one?
Man, I feel like there are a lot of places, but also there's really only one place we can start here, and that is this defensive effort. I mean, if you would ask me to guess how many, again, not to like belabor though, this is not the game we expected, but like, man, if you would ask me to guess how many touchdowns ECU was going to score on Saturday, I'd have picked a lot of numbers before I got to zero, Sam. I don't know what the highest number I would have gotten to would have been before I picked a zero, but it would have been a high number. And you know, it's kind of strange when you look at the box score, because the Pirates actually ran the ball quite well with Keaton Mitchell to 128 yards on 14 carries. But you know, like kind of like you mentioned, they fell behind Houston so quickly that they had to throw the ball to try to stay in it, and Houston just frustrated everything that the Pirates wanted to do through the air. Holton Ahlers, you know, I was surprised to look at the box score and see that he only took one sack. I felt like Houston really affected him on a lot of plays and never let him get super comfortable. You know, we've seen other teams plan around the Houston pass rush, you know, run a high number of pass plays that are very quick developing, and teams have had success with that against the Cougs. And ECU didn't seem like wanted to do that. I thought the one sack of Holton Ahlers might make you think that that was a good strategy for them, but it felt like it led to a lot of Ahlers, you know, throwing the ball before he wanted to, which was a big part of why he only completed half of his 30 passes. But you know, the other thing for me was Houston defensively just continually getting the stop when they needed to. You know, in a season where Houston has made a lot of plays defensively, they've created a lot of negative yardage, but you know, how many times on third and long, fourth and long have they gotten burned? And it's just been never getting off the field when they needed to. On Saturday, we saw them get just every stop. They turned ECU over on downs four times on the Pirates' only drive of more than 50 yards. You mentioned the Cougs able to, really shouldn't have been able to hold them to a field goal attempt. It should have been another, fourth down attempt. But, you know, I guess the only thing you can say in Mike Houston's attempt defense is the other four times when he went for it on fourth down, they didn't make it. So, yeah, just individual shout-outs. Atlias Bell, forced to be reckoned with on the interior in this one. De'Anthony Jones, a pair of TFLs, including a sack in the secondary. Jalen Emery broke up three passes in this one. So just lots of praise to go around. But, yeah, continue to be double-checking my phone and re-looking up that score just to make sure that yes, we in fact held East Carolina to 3 points on Saturday.
And I think if you want to look at one thing the defense did really well, one thing that the defense has really struggled with this year, go look it back to the 2021 defense. I thought one of the things that they were good at a lot of things last year, but this defense last year was especially good at getting off the field on third down, getting off the field on fourth down. And that was just one area where you'd kind of fallen off a cliff this year, and you kind of saw a flash of how good this defense was last year with some of these same guys that getting opponents off the field. You would see opponents sometimes be able to move the ball, but come third and fourth down, the Cougars would step up to the moment. And I thought, even though ECU moved the ball at times, I thought they did a really good job. The pass defense that had been really struggling in some of the prior conference games to this one, I think at the half, Ahlers line was something like 9 of 19 for 105 yards. And when I rewatched this one, I realized, because I wasn't able to watch the first half live, that was 9 of 19 with two of those completions being absolute circus throws by Holton Ahlers that had no business being caught. That I think the Cougar secondary's performance really allowing that Cougar offense to get out to that big lead to allow, I think, ECU to really be in a position where they were chasing it. And I think if things are working ideally, because you look at Keaton Mitchell's numbers in this one, Keaton Mitchell's numbers, if you just kind of block out the overall game, what happened there, Keaton Mitchell had good numbers in this one, but when you're in a 21-28 nothing hole for critical portions of this game, it's not like you can consistently go to the running game as often as you'd like. And I think if this team was really going to be an ideal place, it was going to be ECU being in a hole and having to throw a lot with Holton Ahlers. I think Holton Ahlers is a good quarterback. I think Holton Ahlers is a better quarterback than the guy we saw on Saturday facing the Cougs in Greenville. But I think if this ECU offense is functioning ideally, it's a lot more balanced, that they're working a lot more of Keaton Mitchell in there and a lot less relying on improvisation from Ahlers and Ahlers' finest guys. But I mean, it was an offense that I think gave us a lot of heartburn in the pregame. An experienced quarterback playing his senior day game in his hometown with an experienced receiver group against a secondary that, even against bad teams like Temple, had really previously struggled to keep opponents from doing anything offensively. And I think what helped the Cougars is that consistently, I don't think the Cougars were favored in any way here, but I thought this officiating crew really let both teams' defensive backs be physical. And I think you saw the Cougar receivers in turn respond to that. I think you give guys like Tank Dell and Matthew Golden a chance to be physical. I don't think that's something those guys will shy away from. And I think without calling out some young men who are 1,000 times the athletes I could ever dream of being, I don't think you saw ECU's receivers rise to the challenge the same way that guys like Dell and Golden, and even other guys like Keshawn Carter and Christian Trahan do on the opposite sideline for the Cougars. It was a really impressive effort, and it's got to be a hard season. I have called the performances unacceptable, and they were unacceptable. You allowed 113 points from your two prior opponents, including 77 to SMU, but it's got to be tough to be on that defense and still stay mentally engaged and still not give up. And you saw a group that, despite some pretty rough games and just pretty rough stuff to come back from psychologically and to go between the lines and not believe, here we go again, we're about to get shredded by another conference opponent. I think really impressive that the guys went out there and didn't let those previous difficult games beat them before this one started.
Yeah, and then offensively, the Cougar train certainly a bit slow to get going this year, but now that it's built up some momentum, looking like a very powerful machine, and continue to look that way even with Stacey Sneed in concussion protocol and not making the trip for this game. Tayshaun Henry, second game back from injury himself, was the main back in this one. Brandon Campbell in his first game since the USF game had a couple of carries, but you know, Houston didn't get a whole lot going on the ground, but it really didn't need to. The offensive machine getting going has largely coincided with the transition to a more pass-central offense, with Clayton Tune putting it in the air 44 times in this one, throwing for 435 yards and four scores while taking zero sacks and adding 43 yards with his feet. And it just seemed like, even with the, you know, defensive backs being allowed to be physical, Tank Dell and or Matthew Golden open to throw to on most every play, combined for over 300 receiving yards with three touchdowns. That's impressive on any night. It really stands out big on a night where your defense held the other team to under 200 yards passing team, under 200 yards passing as a team, and kept them out of the end zone entirely. And, you know, wasn't even just those two guys either, as Christian Trahan and Henry combined for over 100 yards receiving from your non-receiver position guys, and a touchdown there as well. So, like I said, it's just, it's hard to believe at this point that it seems like it was 5 or 6 weeks ago that I think fairly reasonably we're talking about the need to make a change at offensive coordinator, and all of a sudden you look up and Houston is just running people over and having this offensive thing, you know, again, knock on wood, but there's only how much season left at this point, but certainly seem to have things figured out in the second half of the year here.
Yeah, I'm not going to go so far as to say best offense, because I think 2015 certainly was a great offense that I think did it a bit different than this one, but I think you could make a good case, Dustin. I don't think this is a better passing offense than 2011, but I would say this is our best passing offense since that last Case Keenum season. I think we've seen it consistently enough to say that with Tank Dell, with Clayton Tune, a really fully realized Cougar offense that's been spectacular. What I really liked from this one is I thought it was the right process from Dana Holgorsen and the offensive staff, regardless, before we even get to the results. You didn't go out against an ECU defense that we knew was a good run D. We knew with Stacey Sneed and concussion protocol, and neither Brandon Campbell or Tayshaun Henry close to 100% health, that going 50-50 and pounding the rock against this opponent, I think, was going to be a non-starter. And it was very clear from the beginning that the staff realized that and elected to go with what has worked so well and go with, you know, Clayton Tune and Tank Dell and what's been just a fantastic passing offense to watch. And you didn't run the ball much throughout the game, but I thought in the second half you saw when the Cougars did change it up and go to the run game, you saw how passing to open up the run can work, that ECU was so shell-shocked by this point at what Clayton Tune was doing and their inability to get anything like a consistent stop, that you were certainly softening up the box and there were certainly a lot fewer guys committed to the Cougar run game. And you saw later on Tayshaun Henry have some nice runs. Certainly not a guy that looks 100%, but also I think incredible that he's doing as much as he's done at this point in this game, having had in-season surgery. And I think just a testament to a team that really is on the outskirts of the conference championship game, and that Tayshaun Henry, a guy in his final collegiate season, believes so much in this program, believes so much in these coaches, that he's willing to, coming off an in-season surgery, go out there and try to help this team win a big game against a conference opponent on the road.
Yeah, and I guess my only other thought is, you know, I think the conference championship game is what we need to somehow miraculously be ranked like ahead of UCF and or Cincinnati and Tulane in the computer, the CFP ranking. So
I mean, UCF loses to South Florida, buddy. We might be there, but that is a big if.
I still have a hard time. Yeah, no, I think because it's what the tiebreaker scenario in the American is for some reason, like the CFP rankings that are coming out this week, and then, you know, but yeah, no, I just because even then we'd have to be ahead of the loser of the Tulane Cincinnati game this week, which doesn't seem like it'll be so very, very likely not going to be playing in the AAC championship game this year, which I think was certainly the goal heading into the year. So I think this win against ECU, you know, and I've tried very much to just talk about it in the context of what a exciting, fun win it was, because I think it deserves to be judged as that. But yeah, I think you do kind of have to maybe just have a little bit of frustration with it. Like, where's this been all year? Like, it's great to see Dana Holgorsen's most complete game as a head coach, maybe, or, you know, certainly for this season. But it's like, oh man, I do kind of wish it wasn't game 11 when we were already 6-4 and out of the AAC title game race. But you know, I think the nicest thing I can say about the Cougar performance on Saturday was that it took me until, you know, probably today to start thinking those thoughts again. And that for the course of the game, I think you'd have, as much as you talk about things you couldn't have convinced me of before the game, I think maybe the thing you most couldn't have convinced me of was that I was going to watch that game and be transported out of the like mental context of how the season had gone, and to just really that I was able to dive entirely into the game and just have a fun time watching it and not worry too much, which is the right thing to do. I mean, very few seasons, every single game is going to go exactly the way you want. Not every season, you know, if you add up every single team's expectations each given year, not everyone can do what they want to. So you just, as often as not, you're not going to meet your preseason expectations in a given season. But I think you with any sport, you want to take the wins where you can get them, take the good moments where you can get them. And you know, this season has had some great moments. The Clayton Tune vaulting over you know, the defender to win the game in UTSA to open the season, certainly a great moment. We've had some great moments along the way, and certainly thumping East Carolina 42-3 in their stadium on Senior Day, and just absolutely Matthew Golden and Nathaniel Dell, Tank Dell, and Clayton Tune going off. That's gonna be a lot of fun. And even if the season wasn't everything we wanted it to be, you know, hopefully you're able to be an enjoyable enough person to be around that you were able to just enjoy this one for what it was.
I was just gonna say my only other point from this game, I forgot to mention it. Another fantastic offensive line performance. Wanted to mention that zero sacks. Clayton Tune had lots and lots of time to throw. I think very much related to how well this offense did is that he had as clean of pocket as he had, and that you didn't run the ball very much, but that play where Brandon Campbell could have basically moonwalked into the end zone for the third touchdown at the end of the second quarter, I think fantastic from an offensive line that I think keeps giving you real reasons to be optimistic about the offense long term. I think you're going to have a big, probably Clayton Tune and Tank Dell sized question mark in this offense next year, but I think even with big shoes to fill in those areas, if you have a good offensive line to build around, I think your heartburn gets a lot lower. I think, bottom line, this Cougar team won an as hostile environment just about as this conference offers, did it quickly and comfortably, did everything you could ask for, and I think proof positive this team certainly hasn't given up on the season, certainly hasn't given up on Holgorsen and the staff, no matter the outside noise. And I think that's admirable. And I think that's something that's been a pretty consistent through line from 2019 to present. The results haven't always been easy. It hasn't always been maybe as consistent as all of us would have liked, but this team has never given up on the staff. You've never seen any point where you're watching the game and, oh, it's obvious these guys quit. And I think to see the team do what they did at ECU, a good team this year and a team that's always difficult to beat at their place, I thought really fantastic four quarter performance. And like you said, if you can't turn off the outside noise to appreciate that a little bit, I think you need to reevaluate your fandom at least a little bit.
All right. Well, Sam and I have spent many, many words reviewing this game. So let's get to y'all reviewing this game in four words a piece, because that's all you get, because it's not your podcast. But forward reviews, we do love them. Let's jump right into them.
Starting out forward reviews as adversarial as we've ever started about. I like it. Go in it, Dustin.
So I'm feeling spicy about these forward. No, actually, I'm really excited. We've kind of been a little bit, you know, not thrilled in the past about how It seems like we get a lot more four reviews when the team loses as opposed to wins. We got a lot of them this week for a four win. So was very excited to see the number and quality of them. Well done, y'all. I shouldn't have started out so spicy right up front there. But one of my favorites right up front, Tristan had 3 points. Sergeant Awesome, our old friend Holgerson's first complete game. The Rev Jeff Berger, as I can definitely pronounce words here, had the Holgo coaster rolls on. And then a couple of y'all excited about the Cougs receiving depth. Renee had Big 12 receiving core, and Sam, not you Sam, but a different Sam, had the future is golden.
Yeah, Bryson also had what a golden day. Enjoyed that one very much. Nick had Samson-level defense today. Our good friend Sean had defenses enter the chat. And Eduardo had offense, defense, complete game. I like this one from our good friend Clip at Pirate Radio, who I went on the show of prior to the game. He had Dana is my daddy. Nate had this defense confuses me. And Wendy, I believe, submitted the very first forward review for this week. Asked, are you kidding me? No, Wendy, we are not kidding you. And certainly Cougar football is not kidding you as well.
And then we had both Philip and Reverend Schmidt. We're talking about reverse jinxes. Philip with reverse jinx strikes again. Rev CHS with reverse jinx successfully implemented. I think they're talking about us, I guess, and saying how Houston was not going to win this one. So, you know, I'll take it. I like the reverse jinx framing. That's a nicer framing than saying I was a bad fan who was wrong about how the game was going to go. So we'll go with that. Casey and Cypress had better late than never. A lot of general confusion. Jay Aguayo Corona had I don't understand us. I think you mentioned Nate. This defense confuses me. Jim, this team perplexes me. And Kid Canales, I am so confused. And then our good friend Ryan had long may he reign in reference to Shasta the Seventh now being at the Houston Zoo. And then finally, I think the only, remarkably, I believe the only like pirate pun or yes. pirate plan words that I saw there. So I had to include it was from Vin, who had we shivered their timbers.
I had that as my last and favorite one. The only one I have that you haven't mentioned, a lot of really good ones here. Like you said, Aaron had really, really appreciate Tune, and I would co-sign that. It's been fantastic to really see the offense put it all together around him. He's stuck with this program through some difficult times, and it's been really awesome to see in the second half of the season a guy who clearly worked his butt off to get this program in better shape, at least be rewarded with being a critical part of a very good offense.
All right, that's all for forward reviews. Let's go ahead and shift our attention from Houston to the college football world as a whole from this past week. Some interesting results around college football starting on Thursday. A conference matchup, SMU at Tulane. We're wondering if the Mustangs were going to be able to throw a wrench into Tulane's AAC title hopes.
Nope.
They were very much not able to do that as Tulane jumped out to a 21-0 lead in the first quarter. Comfortably won that one. 59-24, and again, in the whole college football doesn't make any sense thing, just a couple weeks after SMU was hanging 77 on us and scoring about as easily as they were breathing, they just weren't able to get going against Tulane as we were shutting somebody out, so go figure.
Yeah, it felt like Tulane was taking out years and years of bad head-to-head results on SMU in this one.
And then a result that very much did kind of throw a wrench into the AAC title race was on Saturday morning, in which Navy holds UCF to just 14 points and comes away with the 17-14 victory, despite the midshipmen having just 3 points after halftime. That was enough. And yeah, Mikey Keene in this one, not a lot of success. John Rice Plumbing in this one, not a lot of success. UCF just... continues to be a pretty hard to predict team. You know, I believe highest ranked group of five team in the poll coming into this one. So not what I really expected at home to score just 14 points and fall to Navy. But I guess that is UCF gets to be the team that gets stung by the Service Academy team, the one last year in the American.
And we were talking in those forward reviews about how confusing this Cougar team is. I would argue UCF has been even more confusing in the current year. Just went and got their butts kicked by ECU and Greenville a few weeks ago. Went out there and kicked Tulane's. But a good Tulane team, as good of a Tulane team as there's been in the last 25 years. In New Orleans, though, they let the Greenies probably hang around a little bit longer than they should have in that one. And then to go out and lose this one to Navy, who I think Navy is better than the last couple years. I think they've been very hot and cold, and this is a Navy team that beat, I think, a pretty solid ECU team. I just really hard to figure what's going on with the midshipmen, but they seem to be a bit more dangerous than they have been, at least in the couple years prior.
And then going from our current conference to our future conference, TCU is at Baylor. Certainly some big college football playoff implications there. And, you know, Baylor took an 8-point lead in the fourth quarter in this one before the dramatic TCU comeback. They got the touchdown with about 2 minutes to go, but failed the 2-point conversion, still trailed by two, got the ball back in the last minute, went down. And a play that looked like they were going to run out of time is at about 17 seconds on the clock, ran a play that ended inbounds and then like sprinted their field goal kicking team out there, but their field goal kicker hits the 40-yarder as time expires. TCU goes to 11-0, stays very much alive in the college football playoff, robs Baylor of a win that they wanted, which is always so beautiful. And I thought this was remarkable. The last two Big Ten teams, they said this during the telecast, the last two Big 12 teams to start the season 10-0, both lost to Baylor in game 11, and TCU does not become the curse of the threes there, overcomes that. And, you know, I love it. You know, not that I'm a huge TCU fan, I guess, or whatever, but I guess, you know, in the interest of seeing our future conference hopefully get a team to the playoff, in the interest of just, you know, thumbing our, the nose at all the talking heads who have wanted to look down their nose at what is a very strong schedule that the TCU has faced. Excited to see the Horned Frogs keeping this one going. And like I said, always good to see Baylor lose when they thought they had something.
I saw a quote from Sonny Dykes about how I think they practice 11 seconds to get out there and get the field goal off. So they had 16 in this one, so they were never really that worried. I question in real time whether Sonny Dykes' heart rate didn't go up at least a little bit before the Horned Frogs hit that game-winning field goal. That rivalry game against TCU and Baylor never disappoints, and Saturday morning was no exception there.
Just real briefly mention as we're talking, again, the playoff a little bit, just kind of some interesting almost results from the Big Ten as Illinois nearly beat Michigan before the Wolverines got, I believe it was a last second field goal in that one, and as well as Ohio State getting all it wanted from Maryland before winning. So those two teams do go into next week, both 11-0, but, you know, in terms of the whole, oh, who have they played, and in terms of, TCU getting some flack for not always comfortably winning every game on the schedule, you know, both Ohio State and Michigan faced probably a worse team than, well, I guess maybe not Mammoth Maryland, I was going to say. Definitely Illinois, I think I can comfortably say, is a worse team than anybody in the Big 12. Maryland would not be one of the better teams in the Big 12, and they both nearly lost those games. So, you know, college football is difficult, and certainly TCU, I think, as you know, for 11-0, deserves every credit that they're getting, and how much trouble those Big 10 teams had on Saturday, I think, speaks to that.
Would agree. My quick mention here has not have anything to do with the playoff, but Vanderbilt beat Florida 31-24. I mentioned this, Dustin, because it guarantees that even if they win next week, A&M will have fewer or the same number of wins in the SEC as Vandy, which is just, for me, the mark of a fantastic college football season.
We love it. That is a beautiful note. I actually don't have any other, I think, as I'm looking at it, I don't think there's really any other games. I'm certainly not going to talk about the Iowa State mess, so I don't think any other games from Week 12, Sam.
Just a quick mention, I thought USC, UCLA in the evening was quite entertaining, I think, even if you don't have a rooting interest. I know for you, it's probably difficult, because that's like an A&M-UT game for me as a kid. It's just like, I don't like these fan bases. I don't care who wins. I really just don't want to hear them talk. I'd imagine there's something lingering for you even after years of not living in Southern California towards UCLA or USC, but I think if you're a college football fan, it was just undeniably an incredibly entertaining game, and South Carolina just running over Tennessee 63-38 was kind of the WTF result of the week. I was physically present for Utah and Oregon at Austin Stadium, which I can report back as being a really cool game day atmosphere there, that it was 33 degrees and 8 p.m., and that they pretty much had that place 99% full and loud. I gotta admit, I knew the place was known for their passionate fans. I knew it was one of the louder places in college football, but I still left impressed, and I also still left in the third quarter because it was 25 degrees, and I had lost feeling in my fingers. Even it was as Utah was getting competitive again, and I just realized, like, you're not going to be not physically harmed if you stay at this game for the duration, Sam. Get out now. It was a really cool game, but also about two-thirds of the way, and I felt the self-preservation need to leave Oregon. Ended up squeezing that one out in a game that was probably pretty cathartic for them because Utah just ran over them two different instances last year. But nothing else really to note from the week that wasn't college football on my end.
I was just going to say, just FYI, the I want neither of them to win, but I always just find myself kind of inherently rooting for UCLA over USC in football and vice versa in men's basketball just because it's like, yeah, I don't want either of these teams to win, but if I have to pick one, I'll pick the less traditional power. Although I will say, now, you know, dating someone whose family's all Oklahoma fans, you know, rooting against USC football becomes even a little bit easier, I guess, because I'm with the team on that one. So I guess go Bruins. They didn't quite pull it out, so it's too late now. But either way, I think that's it for the week 12. So let's take a look forward to week 13. And that starts with, well, it doesn't start with, but it's in our hearts, it starts with Houston closing out the season at home against Tulsa on Saturday. Golden Hurricane closing out year 8 of the Phillip Montgomery era. And, you know, something that I was kind of thinking about as I looked at Tulsa this week and as I looked at Phillip Montgomery and him still being around for year 8 is something that I believe it was Bill Connolly often said and kind of coined the phrase, at least in my mind he did, which is hard jobs stay hard. You know, Phillip Montgomery has had some success here. His second season, 2016, they won 10 games. He had a nice two-year run in 2020 and 2021, including the 6-0 AAC regular season in 2020. But hard jobs stay hard. It's really hard to win at Tulsa, going up against a lot of teams in the American Athletic Conference that have a lot more resources and often, in many cases, a lot more access to nearby recruiting talent than do the Golden Hurricane. And, you know, without having a... you know, some of the talented players that they've had and having really kind of a lot of developmental guys kind of come and, you know, develop at the same time. You have years like this year where they're 4-7. Their only AAC wins are Temple and USF, who they beat by a single possession at home last week. Their only non-conference wins were FCS, Jacksonville State, and extremely bad Northern Illinois. So, yeah, I don't know, Sam. It's a Tulsa team that certainly, you know, in our long history of being in the same conference with them, a history that I'm very excited to put in the rear view. They've certainly had plenty of seasons of doing more with less and beating us, even as we felt like we should not be losing to a team like them. But again, didn't expect 42-3 last week, so I don't want to be too cocky. But this doesn't feel like a team with a lot of juice behind them to come in and pull the upset on Saturday.
Yeah, this is an opponent with the offensive pieces to maybe give a team that's been defense deficient at times some problems. I will say, look at the head-to-head of these programs in recent seasons, even though the consensus seems to be that Phillip Montgomery is more at risk of losing his job now that he's, you know, been in season prior, I don't think it looks like a Tulsa team that's quit on the year, but it is a pretty defense deficient Tulsa team in their own right that is going to struggle to get stops, I think, with any consistency against this Cougar offense. I don't think there are too many scenarios where this Tulsa team would have been competing at the top of the AAC this year, but I think Davis Britton getting hurt in that surprisingly competitive non-conference game against Ole Miss and the season kind of coming off the rails after that does kind of feel like a tantalizing what if for Tulsa football and for Phillip Montgomery, who I think likely wouldn't be on nearly as high of a seat if Britton stays healthy for most of 2022. But that defense is bad enough that probably would have always capped this Golden Hurricane team's ceiling. And like you said, hard jobs stay hard. And this is, I believe, the smallest enrollment Division I school out there. Tulsa is good football territory. High school football is big in Oklahoma, big in the Tulsa metro area. So it's not that you're not near Division I talent, but I think like any program that's not a brand name, even to some degree Houston, though I think to much less of a degree for Houston than for Tulsa, you're fighting the big brand names. And Phillip Montgomery, to his credit, has done a good job finding guys with those big programs missed. Zaven Collins from a couple seasons ago was a first-round pick, was, I think, in the 2020 season, a good argument for being the best all-around defensive player in the country, was a zero-star recruit out of a small town near Tulsa. Jackson Player, who was a multi-time all-conference lineman who ended up grad transferring to his hometown school, Baylor, who probably didn't give him a sniff as a high school player out of Waco. They've done a good job discovering overlooked guys. It's just, I think this is a hard job to win at consistently. I think Montgomery has given a lot longer of a leash than a lot of guys would have just because of Tulsa being a smaller private school. Tulsa, in years past, though, I think the situation is not nearly as acute now, having some financial issues and kind of going to Frank Haith and Phil Montgomery and being like, hey guys, we're really not in the mood to buy you out, but you'd really be doing us a solid if you took a bit of a pay cut and we kind of gave you a bit more stability. So I think Montgomery's kind of having to pay the piper on that one, that I think a lot of guys would have lost their job after that run from 2017 to 2019 that Tulsa had under him. But I think you can't overlook that he's had some really positive moments. This is just a very hard place to sustain any kind of consistent success. It is a lot harder to say 90 minutes into this podcast than it is 1 minute in.
Fair enough. And yeah, I mean, you talk about Davis Brin and the possibility there of, you know, if Davis Brin stays healthy all year, maybe this year feels a little bit different for Phillip Montgomery and for Tulsa at large. And, you know, Brin has been battling injuries, as you mentioned. Didn't play last week against USF. Haven't seen if he's expected to play against the Cougs. I don't think an announcement has been made yet. But and you're okay, well, if he'd stay healthy. Tulsa's also given up 42 sacks this year. If you give up 42 sacks, I don't think you get to be like, well, what if our quarterback stayed healthy? Well, if you give up 42 sacks, your quarterback's probably not going to stay healthy, because those are plays that have a higher likelihood of injuring your quarterback. And that's, you know, I think part of the reason that Tulsa, even for a unpredictable Houston team, shouldn't scare you too much is that they just, you know, they've really struggled in the trenches. They've given up 42 sacks, have only 14 of their own. You know, the tackle for loss is just very one-sided as well. And it's a team that has been giving up way too many negative plays and has not been creating enough negative plays of their own. And yeah, you know, Davis Brin, when healthy, if he is magically back to 100%, I think he's someone that can scare you somewhat. You know, Keelan Stokes, 1,100 yards receiving plus already coming into this year, and you know, pretty good number two in Juan Carlos Santana as well. So there's certainly some passing ability there, and you know, Houston is like I said, a week removed from looking pretty disastrous in the passing game. So you know, I feel like there's not. No risk there, and you know, you look at Denaric Prince, a guy that started the season unavailable, and it has now been available the last seven games, and has had some strong games, but he's had, you know, a couple of 200-plus yard rushing games and wins over Temple and USF, but has yet to break the century mark against anybody else. So, you know, I guess it's a Tulsa team that, you know, for one, you don't know if Davis Brin's going to play, and that's kind of the big, I think. X factor going in here, unless I'm mistaken, that is known, and I've just been saying this incorrect information this whole time, and Sam has been politely waiting to correct me. I don't know, but
I have not seen anything conclusive either. So, okay. So either I'm right or we're both wrong in numbers.
Well, there you go. But yeah, just to close that thought up, it's with as deficient as Tulsa has been defensively and as good as Houston has been offensively recently, you kind of feel like Houston's going to score some points, and this isn't a Tulsa offense right now that feels like they are necessarily cohesive and 100% and healthy enough to threaten the Cougs. And again, albeit a Cougar defense that was struggling mightily until a week ago.
And I think their backup quarterback's a really intriguing guy, Braylon Braxton. I think the guy that we're going to be most likely to see against the Cougs when these teams face off. He's coming off a really good game last Friday against South Florida, with the heavy dose of context there being that he was going against perhaps the very worst defense in Division I FBS. But you also add to that he hasn't topped 57% completion against any other FBS opponent. Maybe we're talking about a guy who's a longer-term project, but I think he's a genuine prospect. I think he will, if he plays and starts, make the UH defense pay at least a couple times with his legs. You've seen the Cougars this year struggle at times with more mobile quarterbacks, and he has a very good receiver to lean on in Keelan Stokes. At this moment, I think Stokes is either broken or is on the verge of breaking most of Tulsa's career receiving records in that program, and I think considering how we've seen this Cougar pass defense play at times, it doesn't fill me with a huge amount of confidence, even if we're coming off a good game against ECU, that we'll be facing a very good, very veteran receiver in Stokes. On Saturday, they have three running backs who have had at least 56 carries this year. Denaric Prince and Steven Anderson are your leaders. Braylon Braxton probably won't call his number 20-25 times, but I think he'll certainly make the Cougars pay if he has a chance outside the pocket. That offensive line, like you said, though, real big bugaboo. I think they came into the season with none of their projected starters having any career starts before this season. I think they were the most inexperienced offensive line in the sport, which I think goes back to what we said originally about the challenges of turning over position groups when you're not a highly resourced group of five program, when you're a group of five program that's at a bit smaller school. And that's not me being condescending to Tulsa. It's just, it's harder to turn over a position group like offensive line, even if you're a University of Houston, even if you're a UCF or a Cincinnati. I think the challenge becomes a lot more acute at a program like Tulsa. But I still think that, if nothing else, last week proved that this Cougar defense hasn't quit on the season, and it's coming into this one with the vibes as good as they've ever been for this group. And I think the other side of the ball, the Cougar offense should expect to do quite well against this Tulsa defense. I think a couple of guys have really loomed large with regards to this Tulsa defense, guys who aren't here this year. Joe Gillespie, who oversaw the prior three seasons of mostly quite good defense in Tulsa, he left this offseason to take the same job on Sonny Dykes' staff at TCU and was replaced by one of his position coaches, and it just has not gone as well. And a guy I mentioned earlier, first-team all-conference selection, Jackson Player, elected to use that extra COVID year to play Big 12 football as hometown Baylor Bears. I mean, you did have returning guys like Justin Wright, like Tyon Davis, just to name a couple, but I think unmistakably the results have just fallen off a cliff for this unit, and that they only have, I think, 14, 15 sacks this year in 11 games. That's pretty terrible. I think a Cougar offensive line that's, I think, playing their best ball this year has to be looking at that one, licking their chops. Probably your best extended run from a Cougar offensive line since Holgerson's gotten here, and to go against a defense that's really having a hard time generating consistent pressure against opposing quarterbacks, I think has to be music to the Cougars' ears. I mean, last week's results don't guarantee this week's results, but I'm at the point where I feel comfortable enough in this Cougar offense to really feel like we're going to see a big game. We should certainly expect on senior day to see a big game, to see consistent dominance, at least on that side of the ball, at least from that unit.
And then moving right along, we did want to, for at least one more week, look around college football and talk about some other games that are interesting to us. And certainly, I think you have to start, I guess you could start on Thursday on Thanksgiving Day, the Egg Bowl, I guess, just because it's a fun rivalry game. And that's kind of, I think, the fun thing about this week is that you get a lot of games that even if, you know, the college football playoff implications aren't there, even if the conference standings implications aren't there, it just seems like a lot of fun, crazy stuff happens when you get some of these matchups in the Egg Bowl. Always seems to be one of those. But in terms of games that actually have interesting implications.
I was going to give an endorsement of the Egg Bowl because it's
okay,
quite
so, okay, I won't move on then. Give your sell me on the Egg Bowl, Sam.
Obviously, we're not big SEC honks here, but it's the only SEC rivalry game that I would say I go out of my way to watch every year. I don't even really watch most Iron Bowls unless it's just an absolute heater between Auburn and Bama, but this one's quite often really wild, and I think the shining example was that 2019 Egg Bowl was a really wild, really chippy back-and-forth game. Looked like for everything Ole Miss had tied it was going to send it to overtime, but the Ole Miss receiver who caught the touchdown pretended like he was a male dog peeing on the turf, got the PAT, moved back 15 yards, it was missed, and Mississippi State ended up pulling out one of the more bizarre one-point wins you will ever see, so I would say your best bet for entertaining football on Thanksgiving Day, certainly over the three NFL games that you regularly get served on that day.
And then Friday morning, Black Friday morning, 11 a.m., Tulane at Cincinnati. The two remaining one-loss teams in American Athletic Conference play. The winner of that game will host the American Athletic Conference championship game, and entirely possible that it'll actually end up being a repeat of whoever wins, although I think UCF, good chance to play themselves back in, but who knows what the other computer standings are going to do. But, you know, it should be a lot of fun between a Tulane team that's been just kind of the, you know, trendy upset team all year versus the Cincinnati team that was, you know, I think why they expected to be there even after graduating a lot of talent. Very, you know, prolific at times, Tulane offense going against what has been a unsurprisingly quite stingy Cincinnati defense game at Nippert Stadium. Should be a lot of fun on Black Friday morning.
Yeah, it would be Tulane's biggest win in almost 25 years if they can win this one and punch their conference championship ticket. And again, we're still talking about a five-year-long home winning streak by the Bearcats. It has been a long, long, long time. Major Applewhite was in his first year coaching the University of Houston football program the last time the Bearcats dropped a home game. Really just incredible stuff.
I do not, I mean, I guess, again, like there's some rivalry games that are there, but I don't know. Do you have any other Friday games just really circled, Sam?
I don't. I was surprised. Usually I feel like Friday has at least a bit better of a slate of games. I just didn't really see anything that interested me outside of Tulane-Cincy.
And then certainly the big game everyone's going to be talking about early on Saturday. I guess we do have to mention it. East Carolina Temple, huge I guess in Michigan, Michigan, Ohio State. And again, I think probably mentioned it as much as we already needed to in this episode, but, as much as we want to be sarcastic about the Big Ten and everything, I get 11-0 versus 11-0 is kind of cool. And having a rivalry game have that kind of massive implications onto it. Yeah. It's kind of fun from a college football standpoint, even if would like to see both of these teams manage to lose somehow.
Would agree with that. It's a rivalry that I think is very deep-seated and one of the most storied handful in the sport, even as an avowed hater of those two programs like me can admit. I thought you were setting up for Rice going to North Texas with the chance for 6 wins at the last grasp for the Owls.
Chance for 6 wins for Rice and also North Texas having a chance to still play themselves into the Conference USA Championship game. So not insignificant game there. And then, yeah, the rest of the good day, definitely some interesting rivalry games. You know, Oregon State's one that I'm going to try to make a point to watch on Saturday. If for no other reason that, it seems like it's been a long, long time since both Oregon and Oregon State were good in football. I guess mostly since Oregon State was good in football. So getting to see that game actually be more meaningful. And then later in the day, Washington State too, a game that has seen, quite often Washington State being the significantly worse team. Just a couple of games that I think should be fun and, obviously very, very heated rivalries. And those are a couple of interesting. What other rivalry games are you watching on Saturday, Sam?
I was going to say, the two that you just mentioned, the Civil War between Oregon and Oregon State and the Apple Cup between Washington and Washington State should be two of the better ones on the schedule on Saturday. I like these games, frankly, more for the rivalry trophy name than the actual games themselves, but Minnesota, Wisconsin for Paul Bunyan's axe, one of the absolute best, and Purdue, Indiana for the old Oaken bucket as well. I think a game with maybe a little bit more, I guess, actual football intrigue, I think, is the Sunflower Showdown between Kansas and K-State, which is probably the first time in a good long while that the game has actually featured two approaching good football teams.
And I guess, technically we should mention TCU hosting Iowa State. It's hard to see the Cyclones making that one too competitive, I guess. But, they haven't really gotten blown out by very many teams in Big 12 play, and TCU hasn't blown out very many teams in Big 12 play. So it could be Cyclones with the very outside chance to play spoiler there, but would be awfully surprised as someone who's watched a fair amount of Iowa State football this year.
Yeah, I think if nothing else, that TCU offense versus Iowa State defense matchup could be fun, but it's hard to see the Cyclones coming up with enough points to win this game. And I feel like this is not the first time I come on here and say it's hard to see Iowa State coming up with enough points to win against insert name of Big 12 opponent. I gotta also mention, even though both of these teams are varying degrees of terrible, even though I hyped up one of these teams for a part of the season, UNLV and Nevada Reno playing for the Fremont Cannon, baby. That's happening on Saturday. I don't know if I'd recommend watching it, but it is absolutely happening.
All right, well, we've definitely ended this podcast on what people want to hear us talking about, Iowa State and UNLV football, so I think we'll go ahead and wrap it up there. We are damn near 2 hours into this episode, so you are going to get a very abbreviated outro from me here. shpodcast.com/support, shpodcast@gmail.com, tweet us at shpodcast. You're awesome, and as always,
go Cougs!
Go Cougs!
Vamos los Cougs!
Go Cougs!
Go Cougs!
Go Cougs!
We ain't invited to the party! We had to kick the door in, no cap! No cap!